Radio Lora.
Endlos Sounds.
Endlos Sounds. 120 Stunden Musik am Stück.
Vom 13. bis zum 18. August während 5 Tagen von 5 Orten. Endlos Sounds macht die Vielfalt der Musik aus verschiedensten Genres erlebbar, lädt ein zur Vernetzung, zum Austausch, zu Tanz und Diskussion.
Über 70 DJs begleitet von spannenden Workshops. Komm vorbei oder schalt ein auf Radio Lora 97,5.
Alle Informationen findest du unter endlos.lora.ch.
Vom 15. Juli bis zum 18. August ist das Lora in der Sommerpause. In der letzten Woche von der Sommerpause hört ihr das Endlos Sounds. 120 Stunden Live-Musik aus verschiedenen Orten in Zürich und natürlich auch immer auf 97,5 MHz. Bis dann spielen wir euch die besten Sendungen vom letzten Jahr.
Tauchen wir ein ins Archiv.
36 Grad und es wird noch heißer.
Das ist das Sonderangebot auf Radio Lora 97,5 MHz. Und wir hören nun eine Aufnahme von einer Veranstaltung von den INAF-Aktionstagen mit dem Titel Refugees in Libya und mit dem Sprecher David Yambio. Refugees in Libya fordert, dass Geflüchtete in sichere Länder evakuiert werden, dass Flüchtlinge vom UN-Flüchtlingswerk UNHCR fair behandelt werden, dass die EU die Finanzierung der sogenannten libyschen Küstenwache und der Haftzentren für MigrantInnen einstellt. Sie wollen, dass den Ermordeten, Gefolterten und willkürlich Inhaftierten Gerechtigkeit widerfährt. Gestartet als selbstorganisierter Protest mit einem über 100-tägigen Sit-in vor dem UNHCR-Büro in Libyen, trugen Refugees in Libya ihren Prozess nach Genf vor den UNHCR-Hauptsitz und nach Brüssel vor die EU-Büros und kämpfen täglich weiter für ihre Rechte. Von Libyen über Brüssel bis nach Zürich. David Yambio erzählt über die Alltagskämpfe von Refugees in Libya, in Libyen und in Europa, aber auch über die Verbindungen zwischen Orten selbstorganisierter Proteste von MigrantInnen wie in Tunesien. Er spricht auch über gemeinsame Strategien und praktische Solidarität. Diese Veranstaltung fand am letzten Mittwoch statt im Volkshaus, eben als Teil von den INAF-Aktionstagen. Und der Input ist auf Englisch.
So, then we will start with tonight's event on Fight for Your Rights, Solidarity with Refugees in Libya. We have here with us David Yambio, who has been part of this migrant self-organization since its beginnings and is one of its spokesperson. Tonight, he will tell us about his personal story, how he came to Libya, his arrival, and what situation he found there. He will also tell us about the role the European Union and European states in the play in the creation of this situation. And he will then continue talking about the self-organized resistance that they formed in Libya, about their activities, their demands, and also how the struggle continues until this day. And I think it will also be about transnational solidarities, so how their group is connected to migrant protests in other countries, such as Tunisia, for example, or Morocco. And before we start, I have some practical remarks. First of all, the whole input is going to be recorded and you can listen to it again on Saturday, I think, on Radio Lora. It's going to be an input, so David will talk, and if something comes up, if you have a question, please remember it, and in the end you have the possibility to ask. And then David brought some pictures and videos, and some of them display violence and injured people, so please be aware of this, and you always have the possibility to also leave the room if you feel like it. And in general, as a general remark, leftist spaces are not automatically free of discrimination. So if you feel unsafe at a moment or you have the need to talk to someone, you can always turn to the people with the green stickers. They are part of the awareness team tonight. So I think this is it from my part, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I think my chair is a little bit low. I would like to sit above so I can see all of you, but I don't think that's the case tonight, but I hope my voice is enough to reach all of you. First of all, I'm very happy to have been here, and also thanks to Retta for her resistance, who have contacted me since 4 months ago, and I was very skeptical because I always move according to our activities, which is full of emergent situations, and I couldn't see myself here, but in the end we managed to arrive here, and I'm happy to share this evening with you. As she mentioned, I think for me it's really important that we are not just seen as refugees or victims or different narratives that doesn't match human beings. That's why it is important not to only speak about the common struggles that we formed as refugees in Libya, but also the individual struggles that refugees go through, from refugees to migrants and from migrants to nobody, as we have experienced in the southern Mediterranean and in the North African region. So I'll be happy to interact with you, to learn from you. As a person constantly on the move, I lacked the opportunity to educate and to learn. So in spaces like this, I'm more happy that we cooperate. I take something from you and you also take something from me. In this sense, do not hesitate to interrupt, to ask questions, or to explore your curiosity. I think this is the space where we are more curious to know what is happening. Thank you. So. I think it's usually a difficult challenge to start how to tell a story of someone being born in a country that truly has never existed. And if it did, then it is a country that existed without people. Because when we talk about people or citizens, we talk about a certain society that loves their country. For me, when I was born in 1997, I was born in this tiny space that you see, Ezo. During this time, Sudan was constantly under the siege of war, when people in the south were fighting the northern regime for autonomy, for several kind of recognitions which they were lacking as of that time. At this point, when I was born in an internally displaced camp within my country, my family were immediately forced to seek refuge to the neighboring countries when I was only 2 months old. And at this point, my family had to fled. I'm not very good at graphics, but I try to give an insight into what it looked like when they started to move from these places to the neighboring Congo, because we live here in this tiny border around Ezo. So my family had to walk all around the way to Congo for some years, and then to Central Africa in 1999 when they arrived in Central Africa. Then we lived there as refugees, and constantly in host countries, refugees are put away from society and we don't have access to the resources, we don't have access to the common people where we feel included. But in the other end, we are taught to integrate. And it's a question, how do we integrate into a society that we are not constantly in contact with? So in this place, our place of survival was depending on the humanitarian organizations, the UNHCR, the charity houses. We lived in Central Africa until 2005, and at this point, a comprehensive peace agreement was signed between the warring parties in Sudan, and then the people who were living as refugees in the neighboring countries started to return to Sudan. So the peace procedure started, and persons like me who had never had the chance to go to school, I started to go to school for the first time at the age of 8 in South Sudan. It was also a point where I started to dream like every common child in a society. And people who had lost their belongings, people who had damaged their house, started to reconstruct a peaceful society. This, for me, this dream did not entirely build up because we were being terrorized by the neighboring forces. There was interference from the RLA, which was the Rhodes Resistance Army, fighting in the Ugandan regime. It was an opposition party, but these rebels also, after being kicked out of Uganda, they terrorized a huge population of the Congolese people, and then to South Sudan and Central Africa. So in 2009, I was kidnapped from my family at the age of 12, and at this point, I was forced to act as a child soldier, which is something my country is known for today, for conscripting young children to fight in the army at a very young age. At this point, I lived with the RLA, fighting in South Sudan, in Congo, and then in Central Africa until 2010, where I managed to escape from these traumatizing circumstances, and I was able to reunite again with my family. Just to give you an insight what it means, like, talking about South Sudan, it's a country that lacks industrializations, there are no telecommunications, and the act of journalism is something that has been lacking for a number of years. Otherwise, what has happened in Sudan and in South Sudan is something that the media cannot even be able to document and show it in a true reality. So,
the attack took place Thursday in the mining town of Bria, but reports of it only emerged now. LRA fighters attempted to raid the town, but villagers armed with rifles retaliated. The LRA is one of the region's most notorious rebel groups, led by Joseph Kony, arguably Africa's most wanted man. His reign of terror spans Uganda, the DRC, CAR, and South Sudan. His fighters are accused of killing thousands of civilians, raping thousands more, and recruiting between 60 and 100,000 children as child soldiers and sex slaves. Troops from Uganda and the CAR have been hunting him. They're backed by U.S. Special Forces. But despite assurances that the LRA's days are done, continued attacks prove otherwise.
So what we see here, I didn't want to bring really inhuman footages where people have been subjected to several torture and several kinds of human rights violations that have been committed by these rebels. And when we talk about rebels, these are persons who have been fighting in the region, and they are backed up by Western politicians, by the Americans. It's a question of a common people in a society who doesn't have access to resources. Where do they get these resources? We talk about weapons. The Kalashnikov that we were using to fight were given to us by, were being driven by the Americans, by the Russians, and these are memories that we continue to question. So after surviving from this experience, I returned to my community throughout 2010 and 11. I was able to go to school again, but in 2011, there was a turning point for the Sudanese people. When I mean the Sudanese people, it means the common people, because for the politicians, it's always a point of interest who to govern the society, who to be a dictator. So Sudan divided politically in 2011, and then we, the people in the southern Sudan, we started to rebuild our life and to hope, to dream again that the society, our country that have been terrorized, a country that have been existing without citizens, could once again be nourished, be given chance to dream. But this dream never really existed, because 2 years later, in 2013, another civil war started, I think, which is still ongoing to this day. There seems to be mediations from several international religious groups, including Sant'Egidio, based in Italy. They are carrying out this mediation, but it has proved to be really useless for a number of years. This war has claimed the lives of more than 400,000 people, and most of the young population have perished in this sense. The people that have been sent into exile, including me today, are approximately 3 million. And we are not talking about those who have not been able to leave the country because of financial difficulties or because of not being able to cross from one city to the border. At this point, in 2013, I found myself again being forcibly conscripted by my own government at the age of 16. And this was a moment again where I felt it was inevitable to escape away, because your government is conscripting you to fight your own people, to shoot at your neighbors, to shoot at your colleagues, because of these political dynamics that persons like me had no ability to understand. And at my age, I had no power to resist what was happening. We were given Kalashnikov, different type of weapons, and I fought the war until 2016, where I felt that there was a strong need. When I was turning 18, as a young man, I wanted to understand what is happening in my society, if I had to continue killing alongside my government, or if I had to become a mafia, create a new regime somewhere in a society and start sustaining myself from there, or to become a drug dealer. This is something which is a lucrative business that proves to provide a lot of money to people throughout the world. I looked at this, and I also looked at the people who are just nobody, who choose the way of suicide, who commit suicide to find salvation with themselves. I looked at this and I didn't choose it. But the word refugee, which is why we are here today, came into my mind, and I decided to become a refugee at this sense. But just to give you an example of what it feels to be a child soldier in South Sudan, I try to play this little video.
To give the media commission.
Some of those children wanted to be reunited with their families, and I met a young woman who just wanted to be a tailor and to be able to sew clothes and sell clothes for a living. These are dreams of people that should have those dreams realised. And so today we celebrate the first phase of what will become the largest release of children from armed groups that South Sudan has seen for many years. But it's just the first step. And unfortunately, in other parts of the country, child recruitment continues.
The video you see here is not really the truth, because the international organizations, however they are active and present in these countries where we see conflict dynamics, we see that these stories are being filtered. The truth is not being told to the international community. And the UN system is working not in the interest of the common people, but for political powers. The political will to change the living conditions of the local people is non-existent. The video that you see here, I know almost everybody, every child that is in this video. It is in my community. It's in a place where I was born and raised, but I managed to escape from this. But I'm coming to a point where circumstances like this push young people like me, who would have wanted to grow up in my society and to advocate to be a good citizen in my society, but I was not given the chance. Because at a point where I decided to become a refugee, I was looking at what I'm leaving behind. I was questioning the number of my family members. At this point, it was a question whenever I will ever meet my family again. because before even leaving, I had already lost contact with them, and I was questioning the love of my society, the places, watch, the mountains, the food, the colleagues, everything that was about my country, because everything else that was able to fix itself in my imagination was foreign to me. Yet again, even within these imbalances of not knowing what to do, I chose to truly leave my country, and I left to the Northern Sudan. But at this point, my life and my status became like that of the street beggars, that they are not able to afford for themselves. When you go to the street, you find people who ask you for coins, and when you give them, they feel humiliated because they cannot afford it. And if you don't give them, they still feel humiliated because you do not recognize their situation and their human being. At this point, this was my feelings when I had to knock on the Sudanese authority to ask for protection, to ask for recognition, to ask for an entry to the Northern Sudan. I was rejected because politically they said, you are from the south, you need visa, you need document, you need everything to access, and you cannot be given refuge here in Sudan. I had to continue my journey. I arrived to the Republic of Chad, and in Chad I was given international protection. I lived there for 2 years, and living in Chad was a very difficult challenge again, which had to bring a kind of re-traumatization in the experiences which I lived in Central Africa and Congo with my family, where I couldn't eat the food that I wanted, I couldn't sleep in places that I wanted, I was put in human camps where I survived, but at the mercy of the common people, at the mercy of charity. Chad has been hosting millions of refugees from Darfur since 2003. It has been hosting millions of hundreds of thousands of Central Africans who had fled the war from Anti-Balaka and the Seleka regime. It has been hosting refugees from 2016 between the Anglophone and Francophone from Cameroon. It has also been hosting refugees from Nigeria, from the Boko Haram. At the same time, it has been hosting refugees from Niger, which is one of the poorest countries, which is deserted by this heavy climate change, where people are not able to cultivate and make use out of the produce. At this point, I live in inhuman conditions, and I couldn't go to school. I was completely limited because living in Chad, I was not under the constant fear of war, that I'm going to be kidnapped, I'm going to be taken to war fronts, I'm going to be put in several stages of torture, but I understood that it goes more beyond protection. It goes more about being independent, being able to live in a society where you want to be, being the need to come closer to the common people, the need to educate myself, the need to make love, the need to build a family, and these things were lacking. This had pushed me to find myself in Libya in 2018 after roaming several African countries. But before I got to Libya, I just wanted to give you an iceberg of what conditions looks like for refugees and migrants who arrive to Chad.
Aid groups are struggling to help 25,000 refugees who arrived in Chad from Sudan last week. The recent influx has almost doubled the number of Sudanese refugees in the country since the Sudan civil war began April 15th. To reach the site of a camp housing the new arrivals, VOA flew from the capital, N'Djamena, and then drove 4 hours to the remote town of Barota on the Chad-Sudan border. Here, a settlement that didn't exist a week ago is now the size of a town. The refugees have come from western Darfur, which has been ravaged by lawlessness and intercommunal violence, mostly consisting of ethnically Arab armed groups terrorizing black Sudanese. Sudan's conflict triggered the spate of violence. Refugee Khadija Abeb.
This is the situation. As a person, as young as people can be, how can someone accept to live in this condition without becoming a criminal, if it is so? In the sense that from becoming a refugee because you are pushed away by circumstance in your country, arriving to a host community like this, living in a very unacceptable conditions, you become a migrant. From a migrant, you become an economic immigrant, because these are the terms which are being used to determine our life. Young people like me, once we are in this circumstance, we try to do the impossible. We know that we understand that the policies that have been designed to keep us away and not to give us visa whenever we are in such conditions, we understand that it cannot dictate and it cannot determine where for us we should live. So in this sense, we tend to seek several irregular way to migrate. We approach smugglers. Human trafficking is also happening, because this is where people are being exploited. It was after such experience in Chad that I traveled to Libya. I arrived in Libya not with the intention to cross the Mediterranean, but with the hope that the host community there could receive me, could give me the chance to be included into the society. But after arriving in Libya, what I found upon my arrival was only a nightmare made of torture, exploitations, slave labor. At this point, it was a place where women are defeated by rape, men are burnt by torture, children live without dreams, and several kind of lucrative business that is building an economy to the Libyan society, to the private sectors, to militias, and to the EU member state that have a very strong political interest in Libya since its destabilization in 2011 when Libya was destroyed. If we have to travel back in time, during the time of Gaddafi, I don't think there were boats coming illegally, landing at the Italian coast or at the Maltese territorial water. People were having the chance to work in Libya, to being able to provide provisions to their families. And those who sought refuge from raging wars, from climate change, from poverty, from persecutions, were able to find shelter in Libya. But after this destruction, Libya has become a hub for militias that Europe is creating, because a person cannot become a militia without being armed. Where does this weapon come from? Country like Libya doesn't manufacture a single bullet. And this takes me back to my country, South Sudan, where we have been fighting for ages with helicopters, with armed tanks, with heavy weapons that are not produced in South Sudan. For us, we do not even produce clean drinking water, where 60% of the population does not have access to clean drinking water. And people live in extreme poverty. Yet you see rogue weapons that are being produced in Europe, in Americas, in Russia, in China, and are being given to the common people to kill themselves and disperse them from trying to question, trying to understand what it means to live a free life and to have access to democracy. I'm not going away from the topic. So after being exposed to these experiences in Libya, I was tempted to start imagining, to start exploring the power of imagination, because I still believe that it is the only power that persons like me and you share in common, the power to imagine. For us, after being exposed to such situation, we constantly imagine that one day we can be somewhere in a non-violent circumstance, in a community where we are included, where we are recognized and able to travel free, because it's a fundamental human nature that we are all entitled to. So in return, we had hoped that people here in Europe are able to imagine what it feels to be born in such a country which has faced an extreme destruction of colonial powers, and after colonialism there is dictatorship, where society are not able to breathe. So at this point in 2019, I attempted to cross the Mediterranean, and after arriving in the Italian territorial water, I was forcibly intercepted and sent back to Libya. After being sent back to Libya, I was systematically detained for 7 consecutive months without any judicial review. I was not given enough to eat. I was forced to work as a slave, to construct houses, to cultivate the Libyan farms and provide food for them. This experience, I survived from it where others did not survive. Women were subject to several kind of tortures. They were being used as sex slaves, and young men like me, they could only survive by what their strong body is able to endure. And for women, for them to survive with their children, it means that they had to offer their bodies to the militias. In this sense, I survived for the first time. But once again, Libya was